and welcome to the Parallax Podcast, the film debate movie podcast with the mostest. So I like to say my name is Luke Buckmaster, and I'm joined on the couch this week, as I am every week.
Yes, hello.
By the great man, he doesn't even need an introduction because he leaps on in there before you give him one.
Woo!
Rich Harity.
That's me.
Rich, I was looking at your Twitter profile.
Oh, wonderful.
You're a tweeter.
I am.
And on your About profile, it says you're a film critic, master's student,
yep.
TV watcher, a chronic misspeller,
sometimes.
A beardy blogger, Melburnian, aspiring walker, retired pole vaulter, and a possible liar. So if you're actually a liar, were you lying about being a beardy blogger? No.
Yeah,
a TV watcher? No. A film critic? No. It's... what is it? It's the chronic misspeller thing, isn't it? You always spell your words so well.
Yes. Yeah. I am fantastic at spelling, so I was lying about that one. The pole vaulting thing is true, and I'll tell you about my pole vaulting times maybe after the show.
Please do. And talking about sports and recreational activities.
Yes.
We're going to talk about some films, aren't we? What do we got first up? We got The Raid.
The Raid. It's a ball-slapping action ball-slapper.
It's a... apparently, it's got some ball slapping in it. And after that, we've got, what, John Carter?
Yeah, it's a ball slapping science fiction epic.
Sense of a recurring theme here. And on DVD, we have...
We Need to Talk About Kevin. It's a ball slapping, devastating, harrowing experience. A
lot of slapping of the balls here. And maybe I'll do the last one, Red State. And after that...
yeah, ball slapping.
Okay. After that, Red State's a Kevin Smith film, by the way. But not as you've seen him before, as we talk about later. After that, we've got the great man.
Zach's in town. Zach's
steak right
in
through
the
heart, Hepburn.
Yes.
He's a great man. And he's going to talk about a cult film that's very weird. So I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Yeah, we'll see what he's got to show us.
What's up first?
First up, we've got The Raid. To the Neck, The Raid, an Indonesian action film written, directed, and edited by English expat Gareth Evans, arrives to stab us multiple times before reminding all film fans that the action genre is not dead, despite Hollywood's recent chaotic, headache-inducing efforts to kill it. The setup is simple. As the SWAT team swarms upon the giant 30-floor compound of a ruthless crime lord, things quickly go awry. Psychotic martial artists, machete-wielding drug dealers, and gun-toting thugs come out to play as the cops fight for their lives floor to floor in this amped-up play on Die Hard. This isn't a particularly game-changing film, but rather, it's an impeccable example of how to make a non-stop kinetic piece of cinema that is paced to perfection. Evans builds his set pieces cleverly, escalating from bullets to knives to fists and alternating shooting styles accordingly. This really is a near-perfect example of action cinema. Violent, propulsive, bloody, visceral, blistering, kick-ass, bone-crunching, hyper-kinetic, and whatever other adjectives you want to throw at it, The Raid is highly recommended, and simply the best action film I've seen in many years. How about you, Luke?
I agree with all those adjectives.
Well, and I think lots of critics will agree with those adjectives.
Yeah, they're very good at it. In fact, I liked it how for about 45 minutes, The Raid doesn't even pretend to have a story. It's like, if you want loud, dirty, sweaty, hard-boiled action, 24 bone crunches a second, and so on and so forth. Well, here you go. Here's one stinking big lot of it. And it's not until well into the film that it introduces a subplot involving family and allegiances and so forth. And, you know, that's obviously tacked on. It's a kind of halfway thought. Not really convincing at all, but as you said, this is a visceral film.
I disagree. I don't think it's unconvincing. I think you've got to add some kind of structure to hang 100 minutes of film.
I still think
on.
It's totally... I mean, I don't want to give away what happens, but it's really tacked on. But I think this is about the action, and the action comes on like a freight train. If you're capable of nodding off while watching this film, you just don't have a pulse.
I do agree.
It's as simple as that. Yeah. You're dead.
I agree. Like... I think the first 45 minutes is a bit more interesting than you give it credit for, because I think the film lays itself out in this really interesting way that's reminiscent of a video game. Like, there's the second scene in the whole film is literally the SWAT team driving to the raid, and they're in the back of a van, and the head of the SWAT team basically lays out the groundwork for the film as if he's setting up a video game.
Yeah,
he's like,
yeah.
We're going to this building, it has this many floors... the big bad guy's on top. He has two henchmen. Each henchman is like this and like that. There's a narcotics lab on one floor, and it feels like a video game. You're gonna get to the narcotics lab floor at some point, and there's gonna be something going on. You're gonna have fights with each of the bad guys. You're gonna have different floors of action. You're gonna go up. You're gonna go down. I think it's a really interesting film in that regard.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely laid out like a video game, and you're right, especially with the levels and going up and down. I mean, even geographically inside the reality of the film, they go up and down. They don't really go left and right, which is a sort of interesting kind of spatial element to it. But yeah, it is set up like a video game, and I'm not saying that video games aren't necessarily well written, but this is not really the height of storytelling prowess. It's about action. The handheld action, or hand to hand action rather, is really impressive. The gunplay is quite good. It's repetitive, like you see the same moves about 100 or 1,000 times, and the film is like this never ending Tim Tam packet of punches and kicks and bullets and droplets of sweat and whatnot, and it sort of almost spills over the precipice of becoming monotonous, but manages to just stay on the right side of it for most of the film.
Any action film is always treading that fine line, like between giving enough action and being repetitive and just relentlessly barraging its audience with sound and fury. And I think,
or story,
well,
subplots, characters, which this film doesn't necessarily have.
No, but you're not coming to this film for that. You're coming to this film for 100 minutes of action. And
you are.
And I think what's clever about it and skillful about it is the way the action escalates and varies just enough over the course of its running time. I think it begins with a lot of gunplay and it ends with a lot of hand-to-hand martial arts. And it saves the martial arts for that final act. And you will get to the point halfway through where you're wondering if there's going to be any martial arts, if it's just a shoot-em-up film. But it transitions really cleverly into different forms of fighting, and it shoots them differently too. Like, it alternates between handheld and just
gunplay,
flat, wide martial arts.
But it's a really violent film, we should say that.
It's very violent.
An excessively violent film. Do not take your grandma to see it.
No, you're going to see a lot of people getting shot in the head and stabbed in the neck.
Yeah, all that sort of, you know, bright bubblegum sort of stuff. I think this is an exhausting film.
I think so. If you're averse to subtitles and you don't usually go to the cinema and see subtitled films, put that on hold, because I think you're going to have a lot of fun with this film. There's
not much talking in it.
Well, there are, long stretches where you're not really reading anything, I'll tell you that much. You're seeing some of the best action I've seen in a very long time.
But there is plenty of talking in the Parallax podcast.
Indeed.
Captain John Carter, Virginia. Virginia. Virginia! No. My name is John Carter. I'm from Virginia. Virginia.
Disney's $250 million sci-fi swords and sandals epic John Carter was helmed by Pixar maestro Andrew Stanton, the director of Finding Nemo and Wall-E, and was adapted from a 1917 intergalactic novel from sci-fi author Edgar Rice Burroughs. The eponymous protagonist, played by Taylor Kitsch, is a Civil War soldier transported to Mars, where he has gravity-defying new superpowers that make him a fairly valuable commodity. He becomes a prisoner of the Tharks, a civilization of green four-armed aliens, and becomes embroiled in the plight of a beautiful princess, played by Lynn Collins. Rice Burroughs' source material employed conventional devices well before they became, well, conventions, so there's a litany of familiar sights and sounds to absorb in the film, and yet John Carter still manages to carve out a fairly distinctive niche. It's a spectacular film, its worlds are pretty vividly rendered, but perhaps most importantly, the narrative is organised and chopped up and rearranged in unconventional ways. How it unfolds is not only exhilarating to watch, but also kind of strangely innovative considering how large a profile this film has. Rich?
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with you. I think it's interesting because the film is familiar. It's incredibly familiar, and I hate to be that guy that goes, you need to view it within a certain context or frame, but I do think that there's a lot to get out of John Carter if you do view it within the frame of understanding the source material and understanding the fact that Burroughs' novel and series of novels from the early part of the 20th century basically was so incredibly influential on all of modern pop culture. Literally everything that we know and love from the last 50 to 80 years has been lifted or influenced by this singular text. From Star Wars to Avatar to Superman to Flash Gordon to Indiana Jones.
Buck Rogers. Star Trek. Gladiator.
Dune. Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
You name it, and there's some kind of element of what Burroughs really pioneered with John Carter. So the film does have a sense of familiarity, but it's got this batshit crazy sensibility to it as well, where it goes in so many different places.
Like,
I think you've talked about the whole way that it becomes a story within a story within a story.
I did. I mentioned that in my review of the film. It's sort of based in a world within a world within a world sort of scenario.
Yeah,
it's sort of unusual and...
It's unusual and it's
discombobulating.
It's almost a very modern technique. The film is bookended and framed by Burroughs himself finding a journal by John Carter and reading it, and the film then flashing back. That bookend structure was actually in Burroughs' original novel, which was an incredibly modern meta technique that filmmakers and storytellers are using today.
Ahead of its time.
It was so ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And I think that what Stanton does with the film is give it a really kind of fun, old-fashioned, pulpy quality. And I had a lot of fun with John Carter.
I did too. But talking about for a moment how the film was received, I mean, it hasn't been received as unanimously as we have sort of said.
It's been divisive, to say the least.
And it's funny. Like, John Carter is a strange case study in that there are so many people convinced beforehand that it was going to be a flop. It's almost as if they sort of willed it to happen. And when a big budget behemoth sort of boulders its way onto the cultural horizon nowadays, people can kind of sense a bit of blood in the water. And as I said, it's almost like they sort of willed this thing to happen. It's been criticized for only earning about $30 million domestically in America. It cost about $250 million. But then again, in its opening weekend overseas, it got about $70 million. $3 million of that was in Australia. That's actually not that bad.
It's gonna make its money
It'll
back.
Make its money it's, back.
I think the issue that's it's interesting, and then you've got so many people talking about it being a failure, but I do... In all fairness, think that the marketing campaign has been incredibly misguided.
Really lackluster. Absolutely agree.
And I understand people maybe staying away from some of those trailers that gave it the look of a subpar cross between Star Wars and Gladiator or something. But it's actually a really interesting, strange science fiction story. I think that if audiences go and see it, and I think they should go and see it. I think it's an interesting film. But if they do, I think they'll be surprised by how misrepresented a lot of the advertising
Absolutely.
Has made it.
Absolutely. And the first trailer has got pretty much no action scenes.
No, and then the second trailer is
nothing
all action.
But action scenes. I do think they mismarketed John Carter.
I think incredibly. And it is, as I mentioned, because it's such a familiar story, it is really hard to present it without making it seem like it's just like Avatar or it's just like Star Wars. But I think you need to know that James Cameron admittedly ripped this story off for Avatar.
He spoke about being inspired by Burroughs on numerous occasions.
Yeah.
Unashamedly. So there you go. Look, we both really enjoyed John Carter.
Yeah, didn't
see
anyone coming.
Don't listen to what the rest of the critics have to say and go and see it.
No, I think give it a try. Hey, like, and if you can see it in 2D, do, because I got to say the 3D, it didn't work for me.
Well, 3D is pretty much never a really good idea, is it?
No. Let's not get into 3D issues now, but
John Carter in 2D. Now, that's the marketing line they should have used to promote it. John Carter in 2D.
You just have to rock it a little bit.
Did you say mommy?
No.
Shouldn't he be talking by now?
I wouldn't worry about it too much.
No.
He's just a boy. Just a sweet little boy.
On the back of just 3 films in 12 years, Scottish filmmaker Lynn Ramsay is easily one of the most distinctive and valuable voices in cinema today. We Need to Talk About Kevin arrives 9 years after her second film, Morven Collar, a hypnotically evocative piece from 2002 that I urge you to track down. And We Need to Talk About Kevin is based upon the well-known novel by Lionel Shriver. Tilda Swinton plays Eva, a mother living a lonely existence trying to repair her damaged life in the wake of some horrible event perpetrated by her son, Kevin.
Who?
Ramsay stages the film in a forcefully non-linear fashion, past and present bleeding into each other, creating some truly gorgeous textural cinema. As the film settles, we begin to question where things went wrong with Kevin. Was it something he ever did when raising him? Violent video games? Confused sexuality? Or was he just a bad seed? Caging all these questions within the frame of Eva's highly subjective flashbacks, showing Kevin as a devil-like child, results in an overwhelmingly devastating experience that becomes more a portrait of a woman suffering survivor guilt than anything else. We Need to Talk About Kevin is a truly beautiful and harrowing experience, but I'm not sure everyone saw the same film as I. Luke.
Well, it's interesting you said that when the film sort of settles, we start to contemplate where things went wrong with Kevin. And I think you could equally apply that to contemplating where things went wrong with the film. I think, you know, first of all, I want to mention two really good things. Firstly, it's really nicely shot. The cinematography, eerily sharp. The colour scheme's really impressive. I love the way they play with the colour red, by the way. Secondly, Tilda Swinton is very, very good. She's chilly. She's a great ice queen. She's had that sort of plaudit or criticism, whichever way you want to cut it. Heard it her many, many times before.
Where's your butt?
But the film, that's the butt right there. The film makes a mistake. It makes a whopper-sized mistake, and that's in the character of Kevin. He's constructed as a caricature. He's basically like Mr. Hyde or the kid from The Omen, Damien. There's really no depth to this character. He's raised to be the demon child. It's lazy writing, and it damn near ruins the film, because there is otherwise some things that you can like about this film.
Look, I have heard that criticism thrown at this film a lot. And
justifiably so.
In a way, but it comes down to me, an essential point of interpretation in how you watch the film. And it falls down on the issue of what you need to understand is that a lot of the film is flashback, and a lot of those flashbacks are subjective. They're not truth.
No, I too have heard that.
You're seeing Kevin through his mother's memories.
Says who? If you're going to make a subjective film where the character's memory is actually visually displayed as the so-called reality of the film,
you needed more of a signifier.
You have to come up with a frame of reference.
Swirly lines going?
No, but you do have to come up with some sort of clue, some evidence that all was not what it seems. You didn't get that with Kevin. You got, from the young sort of child raising scenes, you got this evil little kid who just breaks the circuits of believability. He's a little tyke who refuses to play ball. He poops in his pants. He hatches nefarious plots to, get even his mother. It's totally unbelievable.
If you frame those sequences...
It's Macaulay Culkin. It's the good son. Enough said.
If you frame those sequences within the parameters of it being subjective.
Who is framing that? Am I framing it, or is the director framing it?
It's the mother's memories. So you're saying that these scenes that showed the raising of Kevin, they weren't signaled clearly enough that they were potentially untrustworthy memories?
There was no signal. I'm not saying they weren't signaled clearly enough necessarily. I'm saying there was no signal. And if you're going to come up with a Hyde-like character with no redeeming moral values, and no frame of reference to say that this character is, perhaps some figment of lost memories or skewed memories or different sort of ways of remembering your own child, you really have to give some sort of clue, give it some sort of evidence. Otherwise, it just seems unbelievable. And everything else about this film is quite believable. It seems like a genuine, dramatic thriller with a woman, played by Tilda Swinton, who is genuinely haunted, and that comes across as really real, and I wouldn't take away the film one very, very good performance.
So, shall we agree to disagree on this one?
Oh, I wouldn't say that I would agree on that, but no, yes, of course.
Yeah, well, look, I still think it's a very worthwhile film that is out on DVD this week in Australia, and people should give it a go.
And I think it's probably worth checking out for Tilda Swinton's performance, but I've got a lot of reservations about it. A lot of reservations.
I've got no reservations. It was actually in my top 10 films of last year.
I got a lot of reservations, but really good performance from Tilda Swinton.
Well, you heard it first here on the Parallax podcast.
Heard it first. And what did they hear first?
Tilda Swinton's good.
Yeah. Well, you may have heard that first. If you have heard that first, you haven't really been listening or reading a lot of things.
No. But that's who listens to this show.
That's fine. Yeah. We don't have a problem with you.
No, don't read. As long as you're listening to us, it doesn't matter. Don't listen to anything else.
We have all the answers.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have contradictory answers.
I know.
Often.
I know. But that's when I'm usually right.
And that's when I think you're usually wrong.
That's okay. I can cut that out.
What? You're going to cut this whole conversation, aren't you?
Well, we'll see. I don't know.
Hopefully, it'll make the cut. And if it doesn't, then tune in. Next week, it may make the cut then again.
let's move awful on, segue. Shall we?
Let's just move on. Yeah.
This is Special Agent Joseph Keenan of the ATF. We're here to execute a search warrant on the premises on suspicion of violation of the National Firearms Act. Put down any weapons. Come out with your hands up and you will not be harmed. Repeat, you will not be harmed.
I think it's the use of the word repeat that makes this work every time.
Red State is the first and probably the last overtly political film from writer-director Kevin Smith, who's best known for lackadaisical comedies and hazily plotted stories in which characters talk a lot, like films like Clerks, Chasing Amy's, Mallrats, Dogma, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, and so forth. Here, the director, Kevin Smith, switches to the macabre, scungy, meat-hook surroundings of the horror thriller genre. The story follows three horny high school guys who find a woman online apparently keen to have sex with them. The woman, played by Melissa Leo, lives in a caravan. They drive over to meet her and lo and behold, they find that she's bait for a perverse trap engineered by ultra-right-wing religious loonies. They wake up drugged, imprisoned, feeling a little bit worse for wear in the lair of an extreme church headed by Pastor Abid Cooper, played to eerie perfection by Michael Parks. Where Kevin Smith's script goes from this point is quite something. Red State is a hybrid of genres. It's part horror thriller, part hostage drama, part religious and political commentary, and other kinds of stories too hard to pin down in a word or two. But it's an exciting film. It's got frenetic action, some excellent dialogue, tight, twitchy performances, and you can never really guess where it's going. Rich?
I do agree, you can never really guess where it's going, and I'm not going to lie, I had quite a fun time watching this film. I did, and I'm not a fan of Kevin Smith. I quite dislike his filmmaking, especially over the last 10 years.
Really?
He's become quite a horrific filmmaker in my mind. I don't know if you've seen Cop Out or not, but
I have seen Cop Out. I've seen Jersey Girl.
Yeah, these are very, very difficult films to watch.
They're pretty awful.
They're badly
films.
Made in a fundamental sure. sense. But Red State, like I said, I'm not going to lie, it's an interesting and entertaining film to watch. But by no means is Red State a good film. I feel like it's an absolute mess. And to use one of my favourite words, it's a clusterfuck. It is a film that is so all over the shop that, sure, you have no idea where it's going, but that's not because of any skillful plotting by Smith's writing or on his part. It's more just this pleasurable feeling of getting dragged around from horror to comedy to action at the drop of a dime. And it is cumulatively unsettling. And by the time the film gets to its truly oddball climax, you do feel like the film could do anything and anything could happen. And there's a sense that behind the camera, Smith's gone a little crazy and you have no idea what this film's going to do. But I don't really think any of that is intentional. I think it's actually quite a bad film.
No,
that
look,
is
I,
entertaining to watch
I,
in its all over
I
the shop.
I disagree. You say it's over the shop and it's messy, and there is a bit of messiness in this film. Like, I get that. But this is obviously a story that, you know, Kevin Smith wants to spectacularly circumvent audience expectations.
See, I don't...
He wants you thinking this is a horror thriller film, and then a hostage drama, and then whatever else it turns into. I don't want to give the whole game away.
I don't
away.
Think he's consciously misdirecting you and leading you down these dead-end streets.
I think he's absolutely consciously doing it, and I think if he wanted to make a straight-up horror thriller genre piece, it would have been easier than making this film. This is actually a really ambitious film. You know, Joel Goodman plays a pretty major character in a film, yet he's introduced, what, 40 minutes in, would you say? He's introduced well into the running time, which is a signifier that this is a very unconventional film.
The film picks up characters and drops them, and you have no idea who's the central focus.
And who's shaping the story. And why.
But I don't, and I think it's experimental to a degree. It's really interesting to see Smith, not just narratively, but visually actually trying to do something. But I don't get the sense that there's a clever mind behind the camera guiding all my misdirections. I get the sense that it is just honestly all over the shop. And it's entertaining to watch, but it is a total mess.
I think, you know, you can argue about whether the outcome was successful, but I think it's pretty obvious that Kevin Smith wanted this to be a sort of balls-gripping, weird, political, religious film that you just can't second-guess. And I understand you might not like the film, but on those merits, I think it's a success.
I found it entertaining, and I would recommend it to people to see. I think it's an unexpected, fun film to watch. But
definitely.
I still don't think it's a good film.
And a great performance from Michael Parks, too.
He's fantastic.
Feral preacher.
Yes, yeah, he's great.
I, you know, I'd almost be tempted to go to church if I could just listen to him sermonize.
Well, not if he does what he does in the film.
Well, no, I wouldn't want to be put in a cage and, well, you know what else happens in the film.
Yeah.
You'll have to see Red State to actually, you know, find out the morbid activities that transpire in this particular church, fairly unconventional church, I think. And talking about church, come back to church every fortnight for the Parallax Podcast.
Church of the Parallax. Amen.
And now we have our cult movie segment with our resident weird film expert. And by weird film expert, I of course mean some films that are weird. And not the man himself, he is the terrific, the inimitable Mr. Zach, straight through the heart, Hepburn, our cult movie aficionado. How are you this week, sir?
I'm very well, sir. You're too kind, Mr. Buckmaster. You're too kind. And Mr. Rich, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm splendid.
Wow, this is so civil.
Was it that straight through the heart bit that you thought was too kind?
Well, it's not, but
I can juice it up a little bit more.
Well, maybe, but you're a very, very, very kindly man. You like to work the room. You come in, you give people compliments. It's very, it's very smashing.
I get no compliments.
Well, Rich gets nothing.
No, he doesn't. He gets just
get a fresh drink.
And we've had some great arguments this episode too, haven't we?
I think we have.
And we've also agreed a lot too. Zach, I'm interested. Your DVD collection, I assume, is quite esoteric, and there's a lot of DVDs and maybe some cobwebs, and it's probably, I assume, splattered with the blood of 1,000 maimed dwarves. But I'm wondering, what's the most normal film that you own?
Look, there's a lot of terrified people that have entered my sanctum and seen my DVD shelves and have gone blind or got white hair. I mean, they're kind of like that scene from Last Crusade where the guy picks up the wrong chalice and is kind of turned backwards in time. That's a very good question, sir. I'm not quite sure. I mean,
be honest, you've got four weddings.
It's Dear John, isn't it?
There's some Hugh Grant.
I think the channels of Hugh Grant, I don't think of. I don't even have Extreme Measures with Gene Hackman, you know, but I've tried.
Oversight.
The big hit, maybe, with Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, Mark Ball. It's got Lou Diamond Phillips in it.
That's a good film.
It has got, you know, a cast member of Young Guns in it.
So you've still got some.
I think you guys are going to have to come over one day and do a Parallax on the Road. And
Parallax Podcast on the Road.
And then we can suss out that copy of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang from Zach's collection.
I'll be sure the dark secrets in Zach Hepburn's DVD collection.
I'll be sure to hide any late 70s Disney paraphernalia I may have in the process. But
you've got the Black Cauldron. That's still credible.
Like, oh, well, I mean, Tim Burton worked on that. He was fired from it. So there you go.
But sort of more relevantly to this episode, what are we actually talking about? I hate to bring it back.
That's a reality.
Yeah.
Jeez, Luke, you paid me a compliment, now you're telling me I'm not doing my job.
I didn't say that. But sorry. What have you brought to the table?
Today we're looking at a 1979 film from Japan called The Man Who Stole the Sun. And you know that it's a good film because the lead character constantly says that in the film.
Yes, and you know that I love my films that I have the characters speak the titles.
Always, always.
You're reminded of what you're watching.
If only in Schindler's List, Oscar Schindler said, this is Schindler's List. Would have,
I roll credits. It's a whole lot of time. But look, basically, it's a very simple story of a science teacher who builds a homemade atomic bomb and uses it to demand that a Rolling Stones concert come to Tokyo. Only to discover that he has contracted radiation poisoning rather than a bit of satisfaction.
So Jumpin' Jack Flash got some serious case of the gas.
The gas is the wrong gas, and it's not what you want.
So when the giant lips show up, they're not actually Mick
Jagger. They're the Blitzkrieg. It's a very, very, very kind of this kind of satirical sort of take on nuclear terrorism and kind of post-Hiroshima sort of fuel. I mean, it's 1979, so I think maybe perhaps those feelings are still sort of, you know, relevant and stuff. This is very similar to Strange Love in a lot of ways. It just gets so ridiculous. Early on, the main character, Mikado, is taken hostage on a bus, and he meets his kind of arch-nemesis, which will become his arch-nemesis towards the end of the film, the local cop on the beat. I don't have the character's name, but the lead actor is named Butata Sugata.
Ah, Butata.
Oh,
I like his early work. Hakuna Matata. Later work. Hakuna Matata. That's his cousin.
And look, they basically become arch rivals, and their kind of relationship sort of kind of blossoms over the film. It's a very, very, very simple story. The lead character kind of builds an atomic bomb inside his apartment. Unfortunately, his cat does lick one of the atomic cells, and
it's a literal
succumbs to a kind of poisoning. It's not, unfortunately, like Doc Brown's plutonium in Back to the Future. There's no Libyans, unfortunately.
Yes. It's always the Libyans.
Apparently so. But this is a very kind of insular sort of tale. It's all kind of set around his apartment building and whatnot. So just to give you an idea how satirical the film is, one of the last lines of dialogue is the cop kind of gives a cool exchange going, "You like high places?" And our lead character retorts back, "Yeah, fools and goats always do." So if that doesn't sum it up, I don't really know what does. On the batshit barometer crazy scale, we're looking at like a 6.5 or a 7. It's not incredibly crazy, but it's a hell of a lot of fun. And this one's kind of easily accessible. You can get one, you can get it online on import. Yeah. Or you might even be able to find like a crazy video store somewhere that might be able to stock like a Region 1 copy of it or something. But yeah, Man Who Stole the Sun. You could do a lot worse. And if you're kind of bored of Back to the Future, this is your other option.
Cool.
Wow. Okay. Fools, goats, plutonium, poisoning, and more. The Man Who Stole the Sun. Thank you very much, Zach.
Thank you, Zach.
Always a pleasure.
And we'll see you next episode.
You must be Jules. We should make you Vincent. Let's get down to brass tacks, gentlemen. If I was informed correctly, the clock is ticking. Is that right, Jimmy?
100%.
Your wife, Bonnie, comes home at 9:30 in the a.m. Is that correct?
Uh-huh.
I was led to believe if she comes home and finds us here, she wouldn't appreciate none too much.
She wouldn't that.
All right, that gives us 40 minutes to get the fuck out of Dodge. Which, if you do what I say, when I say, it should be plenty. Now, you got a corpse in a car, minus a head in a garage. Take me to it.
Okay, we've reached the end of another Parallax podcast. It's been quite an interesting show.
What to make of that. We agreed, and then we agreed, and then we disagreed, and then we think we disagreed again.
We agreed more than usual, but when we disagreed, it got a little...
We got angry.
Yeah.
You took your top off, you threw your singlet at me.
Yeah, we might...
covered in sweat.
We did have to cut it, but that...
Tears of a thousand...
We need to talk about Kevin's arguments. Debate did last for 45 minutes, and I've just got the bruises.
There was a bit of a punch on.
Yeah.
But that's okay, we're all friends, and that movie that Zach was talking about, The Man Who Stole the Sun, that sounds kind of strange.
It's definitely one of the odder things. What's the odder things? That's what he does. But
it's true. But when I picture somebody stealing something, you just sort of imagine someone grabbing something and then just sliding in their pocket. And when you have the sun, it's a very confused sort of visual image.
You picture someone just shoving the sun down their pants.
Well, that's what I was struggling with.
Walking out of a shop.
Anyway, I think we've covered off on some pretty exciting films this week.
I think there's a lot of good films out there, and if you listen to me, You'll find the really good ones.
And I absolutely agree with that, but I would change the me for me.
Yeah, like I said, me. If you listen to me.
Me.
Yeah, me.
Me.
Yeah, me.
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 Yeah, me. If you listen to me.
confused to me. Oh, what the hell? We'll see you next week, so.
Yeah, well, listen to me. Listen to me.
The parallax of me is just very complicated.
See you next week.